Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 523, titled Catching Up with Daniel Hopsicker. This is being recorded on August 21st of the year 2005. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present to the audience Daniel Hopsicker, the author of, among other titles, Barry and the Boys, and Welcome to Terrorland, Muhammad Atta and the 9/11 cover-up in Florida, now being released in soft cover. Daniel, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Dave, pleasure to be with you.
Well, first of all, let's underscore the last point I made. Welcome to Terrorland, one of the most important books that has been written about September 11th, and the only comprehensive book about Muhammad Atta's many, many activities in and around Florida, is now being released in softcover.
Yeah, this fall. Well, we could call it the most important book you've never heard of. Somebody sent me something somebody wrote about me a week or two ago, mm-hmm. calling me America's most ignored journalist.
Well, you know, there are a number of people who could vie for that title, both past and present. But certainly, I think, in terms of the magnitude of importance of what you've done, and also, frankly, and this, you know, this is not to be kissy butt here, but you know, you've done a very heroic piece of research and stuck your neck way the hell out, and so far there just hasn't, unfortunately, been a whole lot of recognition, at least positive recognition, of what you've done. However, since we last spoke, there has been a hit piece done on you in the Sarasota Herald Tribune, the paper of record, so to speak, in that neck of the woods. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, how it developed was kind of interesting. I discovered quite by happenstance that the book Welcome to Terrorland is the best-selling book in the history of the local bookstore here. Outsold the Da Vinci Code. Okay, I just walked in there one day and they said, "Oh my God, we can't keep the book in stock."
Uh-huh.
So, as you know, our publicity efforts are meager and feeble when they're not non-existent. But for this, we thought, okay, well, that's worth a press release. We did a press release and sent it out to independent bookstores. Okay, apparently the Herald Tribune got a copy of it, and that sort of threatened their hegemony over what is news locally. Must have, because at that point they decided to do a profile on me. Well, if you've ever read a profile of a local author in a local paper, you know, kind of leans heavily on, you know, how'd you find our fair city? You know, I mean, aren't folks grand around here? You
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this gal walks in to interview me and sits down with no preamble, looks at me, and her first question is, "How much money do you make?"
Well, it certainly is an icebreaker, isn't it?
I told her, you know, after I'd gotten my breath back, I said, "It's none of your business." And she said, "Well, you may as well tell me." She said, "We can find out, you know.
We have ways of finding out how much money you make."
Exactly. So the interview proceeded along those lines to the point where I eventually asked her, "Do you have any questions that aren't about money?" And she really didn't. So, the interview comes out, and it's a snarky piece. Actually, just before it came, I mean, they wanted to do a photo shoot, and I said, "No way, I'm not going to," you know, any interview that begins with the question, "How much money do you make?" has got nothing good about it for me. So I'm not going to, I said, "I'll tell you what, I'm happy to do a photo shoot with you. Send me your reporter's, you know, as soon as you send me your reporter's photograph first." And they said, "Well, why would you want her photograph?" I said, "Because I'm going to write about this." And they were taken aback by that. I was speaking to her editor at that point. These people are used to being able to write about you without you being able to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a shock. And in fact, I've got more readers than they do. So after the dust had cooled, I mean, it was a snarky little piece. I mean, it was just bitchy and evil. And I waited. I mean, I that's certainly not the only thing going on here. And I'm working on things I'd like to think of are significant. But when the time was right and my temper had cooled, I responded, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And come to find out, the journalist got fired. this last week, and I have no idea if it has anything to do with me. In fact, I highly doubt it. That was an interest. See, the Sarasota Herald Tribune has some significant exposure here in 9/11, because if the truth ever comes out, people will look at the Sarasota Herald Tribune like it's the New York, or rather the New Orleans Times Picayune during the Garrison investigation. Okay, these people. I mean, in fact, the title of the story I wrote about it was "Terrorist Hometown Paper Discovers 9/11."
Mm-hmm.
If anyone gets around to asking why didn't these folks ask any questions after the September 11th attack, like, they have exposure, and the questions they should have asked are an arm's length long. You know, how did Huffman Aviation, how did these people get in to the airport to begin with? They never should have been allowed in. Rudy Deckers, who was fronting for the operation at that time, has a horrible reputation in Naples. But they knew they were going to be able to get in. They purchased Huffman Aviation for about twice what it was worth, paid cash, before seeking the city's approval. Now, the city has to approve any vendor out at that airport. So, I mean, it would be like, I mean, that the city had said no, they would have been out there $2.4 million.
Mm-hmm.
But they were so, I mean, you know, this is an inside job.
That $2.4 million was paid in cash.
That's right.
Which is
my understanding.
All right, well, that's quite a lot of lettuce to be carrying around, you know. That's a nice little chunk of change.
Money was no object either to the people that ran the flight school or the people that attended it, or, you know, the Arab contingent.
And at the same time, as you've written in Welcome to Terrorland, again now coming out in paperback, often, though, Rudy Deckers was not able to pay his bills, was not able to pay his rent at the Venice airport. He'd then disappear for a while in a Learjet or something else, and suddenly he had lots of cash, which raises a lot of questions about the nature of the business.
Well, so here's the satisfaction I got from the snarky piece the Sarasota Herald Tribune did on me. They went to him, to Deckers, for comment, not knowing that he's, like, totally discredited. And Decker said, oh, this is terrible. I'm out of work. I can't get any business with the government. If I had any money, of course, he has tons of money, but we just don't know where it is. He said, if I had any money, talking about me, he said, I would sue him. I would sue him into hell.
Well, he's eloquent. By the way, you know, one thing we should mention for the benefit of newer listeners, Daniel, is that Rudy Deckers was the fellow at whose Huffman Aviation, Mohammed Atta, and some of the other hijackers were basically, quote, training, unquote, although as you write, it appears that they were already, at least many of them, experienced and in some cases licensed pilots. And in turn, Rudy Deckers was one of the two Dutchmen, along with Arne Krutoff, who ran another weird aviation school, which also appears to have been something of a vehicle for, among other things, some of these the 9/11 hijackers' infiltration and activities in the United States. So that's the context we're talking about here. When we're talking about Deckers, when we're talking about these amazing cash transactions, extraordinary business practices, and the Sarasota Herald Tribune's role, whether intentional or otherwise, in effect, covering this up by putting the whammy on you, this is the context we're talking about. Go ahead.
Sure, that's right. The one-line explanation for September 11th makes no sense at all as in regards to the flight schools, which is the one line is that three of the four terrorist pilots learned to fly at two separate Dutch-owned flight schools, each of which had been purchased about a year before the terrorists began to show up.
Mm-hmm.
In tiny Venice, Florida, a place with this retirement community with the second oldest population in the entire United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this Dutch treat is something that you've written about at great length in Welcome to Terrorland. And again, that is now coming out in paperback. Daniel, any thoughts about why the Sarasota Herald Tribune might have decided to dump on you?
I sense some movement around 9/11. I have been like the world's biggest pessimist about any truth bubbling to the surface. And yet, somehow, this summer, I sense movement. Able Danger, I mean, the big story in the last couple of weeks has been the military intel unit that was tracking Mohammed Atta in the States and tried to, well, the spin that the Republican congressman that brought it out is giving it is that they tried to tell the FBI that they had terrorists in front of them before 9/11, and they were not allowed to by the peculiarities of the Clinton administration, some weak on terror officials. Now I have no feeling one way or the other about that, but the real story, there is that the Able Danger guys that have come forward have said they were tracking ADA in the U.S. in 1999 and 2000. The FBI says he didn't arrive till June of 2000. So, I mean, my whole one line, the whole time, you know, in the book is that the FBI is lying about who Muhammad Atta was and when he was here. And this military intel unit comes out and confirms it. And yet you don't see that, anybody focusing on that. So I think that's highly significant. And that is starting to bubble to the surface.
Something that I just want to interject parenthetically at this point, time permitting, we will develop this more later. But in terms of Mr. Weldon, I believe, was the congressman who was surfacing this story and trying to paint the Clinton administration as soft on terror. Well, the Clinton administration, first of all, did interdict the Millennium Plot. But as we talk about some of the funky aeronautical ventures launched not only by Rudy Deckers, but his partner and some say boss, Wally Hilliard, they tried to launch a couple of airlines, perhaps that belongs in quotes, but Florida Air and Discover Air, which received considerable boosts from people like Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris, two of the linchpins of the Republican infrastructure down in Florida.
And both of those people were shilling for Deckers and Hilliard's operations after Wally Hilliard's jet got busted with 43 pounds of heroin on board.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris are not part of the Democratic Party infrastructure in Florida. Is that correct?
Not to my understanding.
Okay. Obviously, we're being facetious. Of course, Jeb Bush is the president's brother, and the governor of Florida, Catherine Harris, helped to literally fix the election in Florida, which put George W. in power. So,
and the one thing that I found here, the indisputable fact that I helped uncover, is that during the same month that the FBI says Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, the two guys who together took down the World Trade Center, during the same month these two unspeakable people arrived to attend his flight school. The owner of the flight school had his Learjet surrounded by DEA agents with submachine guns on the runway of Orlando Executive Airport, and they found 43 pounds of heroin on board.
And this, as you write in Welcome to Terrorland, the pilot's name was Diego Levine, and this guy had more connections than a switchboard. He basically was protected.
Well, he had connections to recent events as well. Last week, the State Department, there was a little brouhaha because the State Department revoked the visas of three top Venezuelan military officials for being involved in drug trafficking. Well, Diego Levine is or was, at the time of the heroin bust, the chief pilot for Venezuela's Air Force One.
Interesting. Of course, now the spin in the media has been that, well, you know, the Venezuelans are allied with Castro, and it's true. The president does of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, is endorsed by Castro. But when one actually begins digging, it's sort of like the Sandinista drug smuggling story that came out in the 80s. I mean, some of them were involved in drug smuggling, but that was courtesy of your old buddy Barry Seal, whom you wrote about in Barry and the Boys.
Yeah, well, Diego, Dave, the other thing that you and I both know is nothing is what it seems. And that Hamlet's, the line in Hamlet that best describes life today is there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Diego Levine, who was busted on Wally Hilliard's plane with 42 pounds of heroin, is the personal pilot of Hugo Chavez.
Isn't that charming? And yet he also has links to people like Wally Hilliard and others, and their connections go back to some of the Iran-Contra drug smuggling.
Yeah. So who's to say who Hugo Chavez, is or what represents? I mean, I have discovered purely by happenstance that, and this blew me away when I first heard it because it's so contra-intuitive. The CIA brought down the Shah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there are a lot of indications of that.
I have that indisputably from somebody that was there. The CIA brought down the Shah.
Let me just fill in something for the veteran listeners to this show. I did a number of interviews with Farah Mansour, who is a member of the Iranian resistance in this country, and he did a long series of interviews that are available in RFA programs 31 and 38, in which he said exactly that, Daniel, that basically Richard Helms had learned early on. He was former CIA director and the U.S. ambassador to Iran, that he'd learned that the Shah had cancer, and that specifically some of the Islamists were put in power specifically because of their anti-communism to replace the Shah as the anti-communist bulwark on part of the southern flank of the former Soviet Union. So, yes, that's familiar to our listeners.
Now, I know you want to chat about Atta and some of his strange connections. Can I tell you something brand new that nobody knows?
We'd love to hear it, yeah.
For tomorrow?
Sure.
You are the first person to hear this. It'll blow you away. It blew me away. I walked into the local pharmacy here in Venice a month ago to fill a prescription. And normally I get my prescriptions filled at Walgreens because it's cheaper, but there is a local independent pharmacy here. And the pharmacist there, I've known for 25 years because when my dad retired down here in 1979 and 80 after two massive heart attacks, this was the pharmacist that filled his prescriptions for him. So I've had a nodding acquaintance with this man for 25 years.
Uh-huh.
So I walk in there to get a prescription filled, and I go, you know, we hadn't seen each other in a while, and I said, you know, let me get you a copy of my book. I went out to the car and brought him back a copy because he was always nice to my dad. And I said, you know, when you're finished reading it, let's chat because I'll bet you saw a couple things here. Most people in Venice did. Next day I went in to pick up the prescription, and he says, I read your book last night. And he said, as a matter of fact, I did see some things here. He said, Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi were in the pharmacy a week or two before the attack. Well, of course, you've read my book. You know I've got a dozen witnesses that say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell him that. He says, but you don't understand. They were in here with Muhammad Atta's father.
Oh, delightful. So Daddy Atta was in Florida as well.
I said, wait a minute. Muhammad Atta Sr. was in your pharmacy a week before the 9/11 attack? Pharmacist says, yeah, and he was clearly in command.
You've written in some of your past articles, by the way, at www.madcalprod.com, your website, Daniel, you have past articles archived, and in one of those you wrote about Muhammad Atta's father being in the Muslim Brotherhood, correct?
I think that's the general assumption.
Yeah. Another interesting piece of information, which may or may not be relevant, but Muhammad Atta's father was recently quoted in the London Independent.
Saying attaboy about the London bombing.
Yeah, he endorsed the London bombing, said he thought exactly. They were great and condemned any Muslim right. Who condemned the London
right.
bombings.
Right.
And he was identified by name as Muhammad El Amir, which is the same name as the brother of Dr. Magdi El Amir, whom you wrote about, an Al-Qaeda financier represented in a legal case by none other than Michael Chertoff, now the head of the Department of Homeland Security.
So let me finish with this.
Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, I was stunned. Muhammad Atta's father came out after September 11th, said, no, not my son. My son doesn't know how to fly. My son wouldn't hurt a flea. In fact, my son called me the day after the attack. Then, of course, you know, 4 years later, he revealed his true colors by praising the London bombings, okay? So what did you do with the information, I said to the pharmacist. The pharmacist said, after 9/11, he called the FBI. And the FBI sent two young agents out, and they were completely nonchalant about it because they told him they had already been told by a dozen people is what the pharmacist says, that Muhammad Atta Sr. was in town with his son. Well, I'm stunned by this. Muhammad Atta Sr. is sitting in Cairo today, free, and yet clearly if he was here a week or two before the attack, he had something to do with it.
Sure. And now, again, you say that according to the pharmacist, Muhammad Atta's father was in charge. He was the one who was
exactly.
commanding the situation.
The reason they came into the pharmacy was to send a fax. The pharmacy is the only place with public fax within like 2-3 miles. So Muhammad Atta Sr. was supervising the sending of the fax to New Jersey, of all places.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are a lot of Islamist connections in New Jersey, including, by the way, Dr. Mahdi El Amir, whom we just talked about.
Exactly. So, and Ada and Marwan are sitting in the waiting chairs beside the pharmacy desk. And halfway through the process of sending the fax, Ada got up, and the father, in no uncertain terms, told him to sit back down. And he did.
Interesting. Let me just briefly, Danny. This is stunning, and this is the first.
I got something even more stunning.
All right. Well, go ahead, and then I want to recap because this is correct. The first airing of this information.
Exactly. I'm writing about it for tomorrow, so you're the first person. You're the first person to hear about it.
So we're scooping this. Great, fantastic, Dan. Go ahead.
So the FBI agents come in and they pick up his CCTV camera tapes. He's got four CCTV. Every pharmacy has. Cameras that watch the pharmacy 24 hours a day. And 10 days later, they bring back the tapes. They're noncommittal. Thank you for the information. And that was it. So the tapes sat there for, 3.5 years until the conversation that I was having with the pharmacist. And I said, can I have the tapes? Can I screen the tapes? And he said, sure. So he gave me the tapes. I brought them back here. And it gave me, watching these tapes gave me an enormous amount of sympathy for the people in London that had to screen the CCTV camera tapes from all over London after that, because this is excruciatingly slow and painful work.
Uh-huh.
You have to go through them almost frame by frame because it moves so fast. So I spent 40 hours watching 6 weeks worth of videotape footage and saw a couple people that might have been him, but I took the pictures back, and the pharmacist says, no, that's Elwood, that's somebody else, not him. So I'm just about to give up. I go through the tapes one last time, and there it is. The FBI cut out the afternoon of Tuesday, August 28th, 2001, off this man's videotapes, and then gave them back to him.
Ooh, you know, it reminds me a little bit. You suggested some of the analogies to the Kennedy assassination cover-up. When Life magazine published the still frames of the Zapruder film, they actually removed some of them that would have actually shown what direction the headshot came from that killed President Kennedy. So actually, the videotape had been doctored.
I can tell you how I know, because... as you're watching, there's four screens. You're watching four cameras at once, four screens. Your screen is, cut in four. And on the top left is a number on all of the footage.
Right.
And that's either his store number or the security company gave him that number when they started. But all of the footage has this number. And then on Tuesday, August 28th, 2001, you get about halfway through that day, and the screen goes blank, like the tape rips. And when it comes back up, you're watching some footage, but it doesn't have that number. It has another number. And then it goes down again, and when it comes back up, it's the end of the day, and the store's closed.
Ooh.
So the footage, and it wasn't, I don't think they went to the trouble of doing a really thorough job of covering that up. I assume they could have, but they didn't. So here I have, it's evidence that they've cut this man's picture out. Now, I don't know what this means, Dave. I'm not in intelligence, and I have no idea what the big picture is. But what I do know now is that for the last 3.5 years, the FBI has known that Mohammed Atta's father, who was sitting free in Cairo, has something to do with 9/11, and they haven't done a damn thing about it. And boy, that just chaps my ass.
Well, let me recap a little bit about what you've just told us. A pharmacy in what city down there? In Venice or Naples?
Downtown Venice.
Had done some business with Mohammed Atta and also Marwan al-Shahi, correct? And when they came in to send a fax, their activities were being supervised by Mohammed Atta's father, who, according to the pharmacist, was clearly in charge. When the tape was taken and reviewed by the FBI and ultimately given back, that particular portion of the tape was edited out. It was removed, basically, from sort of out of the loop, I guess one could say.
Right. And the most important point is that when they came out to pick it up, they already knew that Atta's father had been there. They already knew, okay? They had heard it from that the pharmacist says. So it's not, the pharmacist could not have been mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I mean, it's about as trustworthy an eyewitness as you're going to find, but still, he could have made a mistake. I thought it was Atta's father with him, but it wasn't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But when the FBI came to pick up the tapes, they already knew.
Well, it's interesting in and of itself, and more than that, it's suspicious. There's a principle of law, Daniel, which is called consciousness of guilt. If you can be proved, or if someone can be proved to have taken steps to cover up a crime, it is prima facie evidence for indictment, perhaps even conviction, I'd have to check that, for the crime for which you're doctoring evidence or covering up. And recalling again another interesting thing. Now, this fax was being sent to New Jersey, correct? The one being sent by Mohammed Atta and his father.
Correct. That's according to the pharmacist, and the pharmacist places the fax.
In a recent British paper in which Mohammed Atta's father praised the London bombings and condemned Muslims who condemned the bombings, he was identified as Mohammed El Amir. In one of your articles and also in some of the work being done by Sander Hicks and Alan Duncan, Mohammed El Amir is the brother identified in a sting called Operation Diamondback of Dr. Magdi El Amir, a New Jersey-based physician who was an alleged, apparently was financing Al-Qaeda, at least according to many allegations. And when Dr. Magdi El Amir's medical business became the focal point of legal action, he was represented by none other than Michael Chertoff, originally the Justice Department investigator in charge of Operation Green Quest, the pursuit of terrorist financing, and now head of the Department of Homeland Security.
Exactly. So, once again, the people who attacked us are the people who were supposed to be defending us. I first learned about how this works in Barry and the Boys when I discovered that the people supposedly investigating drug smuggling are the people supervising the trade. You know, DEA supervisor, head of the DEA, Asa Hutchinson, had covered up for Barry Seal back when the cocaine blizzard hit America. And, you know, later under Bush, he gets appointed head of the DEA.
David, we are almost out of time on this side. Very quickly, give us your website, et cetera, and then we're going to resume our discussion on the other side of the tape.
Hey, it's madcowprod.com, and hopefully some of you folks will go there and buy a book or buy a tape, because that's what keeps me going.
Again, welcome to Terrorland, Mohammed Atta and the 9/11 cover-up in Florida. We're learning more information about that all the time, including today is now out in paperback. Also, people should be aware of the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com, with a wealth of information in print and audio, and also links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU, featuring the entire For the Record series, either available for download on Real Audio and or streaming on MP3 and Real Audio, including all of our previous interviews with Daniel Hopsicker. And by the way, the For the Record interviews, including this one, Daniel, the For the Record shows, including this one, are being podcast by WFMU. So if there's a listener out there who wants the For the Record shows cast into their pod, so to speak, contact Heroic WFMU, and you can get the interviews with, among other of the programs, including the interviews with the Heroic Daniel Hopsicker, my current guest. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record 523, catching up with Daniel Hopsicker, being recorded on August 21st of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. We'll be back with Daniel Hopsicker in Side 2. Thanks for listening.